First, though, to some new ideas about our welfare system being exported to us from politics across the ditch. After the long election campaign, you might be forgiven for thinking that messy politics is a frustrating business, not the ideal forum in which to make good policy for a better future. Well, at a conference in Sydney this coming week, there'll be many people who might agree that modern politics is frustrating with all the pressures from the media and the lobby groups and the interest groups and so on, and political parties themselves. But at this conference, organised by ANSOG, the Australian and New Zealand School of Government, there'll also be some deep thinking about how to better engage with the community and achieve good long-term policies that benefit Australia. My first guest today will set the tone. He's Deputy Prime Minister of New Zealand, Bill English. He'll deliver the keynote address. He's also the Minister for Finance, and his party, over the past 6 years, has introduced big changes to reduce long-term welfare dependency. And as flagged by our Social Services Minister, Christian Porter, the New Zealand approach is coming to our shores. So what better time than the present to speak to Bill English? Welcome to Saturday Extra.
It's great to be with you.
Your speech is called Politics for a New Age, and the conference itself is called Hyper-Government, Managing and Thriving in Turbulent Times. What do you take this to mean?
Well, I take it to mean there's a lot of people who are anxious about whether our political and social institutions can deal with the ongoing challenges of getting a better community and better society. I certainly don't pretend that New Zealand has anything other than answers unique to itself. You know, we're a quiet end of the world. The shock waves that go around the world wash up on our shores eventually. But we've had a fairly particular set of circumstances from 2008 onwards in the government, which I've been part of, that has enabled us to take a bit of a longer term view about some of the long running social complex problems that governments have to deal with, and that's what I'll be talking about.
Yeah, I think the argument of ANSOG is that it's extremely high-pressured, fast-paced, intense scrutiny, and that you need different sorts of support systems, and I do use the word systems advisedly, in place for ministers. Now, do you think you've implemented those?
I think what we've tried to do is focus on value for the individual citizen who expects or needs support, the family with complex challenges, and we're developing a set of tools under the name of social investment, which uses a combination of the now quite cheap technology for using large amounts of data to inform us about what really happens in the lives of people who, particularly those who are dependent on the government, and turn that into decisions that are much more focused on changing their lives and making the individual and incremental improvements in the way government interacts with individuals and families, which is a bit different than the traditional industrial model of big government, where people show up to our institutions, we deal with them fairly well in our hospitals, our schools, our prisons, but many of our long-running problems can't be solved by those institutions. We have to go to where the people are. I use a word that irritates some people, customers. We need to understand our customers in a great deal more depth than government traditionally has and interact with them more respectfully and more smartly.
Now, there's a lot to tease out here, but I'm going to use one line from your speech that I think you're going to give. What works for the community works for government books. So I can't help but draw the conclusion that you want this to cost less.
Look, that's just based on, I think, a pretty intuitive insight, really, that whatever shorter term measures government might take to contain spending, in the longer term, the ideal way to reduce or contain government spending is to have less need for it. And by that I mean fairly particular things. A smaller proportion of released prisoners reoffending, fewer young children being subject to severe violence and abuse, more young people getting through our education system and getting to the world of work with sufficient literacy and numeracy to participate in it positively. Because much of government spending is dealing with past failure, with poor decisions, with programs that claimed a lot and didn't work, And we're just creating and using a set of tools that enable us to be much more discriminating about where spending is effective, because where it's effective, it's worth spending a lot. I mean, just by way of example, the work we've done on vulnerable children show that we have a small number of children who will cost $1 million by the time they're 35. And probably beyond that, they'll be in our system, welfare system, for another 30 years. So when you see that, you can't help but feel a moral obligation to do more for the 6 or 7 year old, because you know that whatever the cost is, it represents a life of misery. And we're here to reduce the misery, not service it.
So how might it work, say, on an individual school level? Let's put it at a school that that child might attend versus another child at the same school.
Well, look, we're picking up some of the work that's been done quite successfully in Australia and extrapolating it so that for children we can see the path ahead. If you look at the characteristics of a 5 or 6 year old, including their socioeconomic characteristics, you can actually, to some extent, predict the path they will go on. And for some, that will be very unsuccessful. And where it's successful, you'd want to know what it is that means kids who come from very disadvantaged backgrounds succeed. And the challenge in education is how to get it, individualise it. Traditional politics around education is that you put, you know, another 100 million in the top of the system and hope that it filters down to the individual child who really needs the opportunities of public education. And so I find myself being able to say to officials, well, look, if you show us a way where you can demonstrate the impact on improving this child's prospects, then we're willing to spend quite a bit more, because in the long run, that'll be a sound investment. And often where the challenge is developing that kind of accountability and focus at an individual or family level.
Yes, now I'm actually quoting from your education minister here that, for instance, in your 2016 budget, you provided a 1% increase in education spending across the board, but you targeted at schools with shared sets of welfare-dependent characteristics. And you might have, say, $80 per needy student instead of $16 for everyone. So that's quite a significant change, isn't it?
Yes, it was a fascinating exercise, because what it showed is that the current sort of socioeconomic rating system we have for some mild targeting of education spending is wrong. It misses most of the kids who actually have the single biggest risk factor for educational failure, and that is from a household with long-term welfare dependency. We know which children they are. We don't actually need to name them, but we know where they are, 136,000 of them. We know they've got fantastic structure with teachers around them, people who can connect with them. But we put that money in, the schools still as yet don't have the tools to be able to tell us whether that extra public resource will make a difference for those children who are at fairly high risk of educational failure. And over the next 2 or 3 years, we'll work with them to get that tool. Now, the challenge is not a lack of political will. We're willing to spend, but we haven't yet closed the loop. This is common across many social services. We haven't closed the loop where the person spending the public money can show government, parents, teachers, that for that individual child, the extra money actually had an impact on their prospects. And that's why we use the term that we're here to change lives. We're not just here to service the same thing that was always going to happen.
This sounds like our Gonski model, I've got to say.
Well, if they've got it down to an individual level, then we'll adopt it. The idea here is to be able to demonstrate the value more clearly. You know, we're trying to move past the model where in New Zealand, traditionally, we've shoveled money into large systems to deliver fairly undifferentiated programs for which much was claimed, but little was delivered. So the measure here isn't how much money did we put in. The measure is the impact on the trajectory of this particular child or this cohort or this community or this family.
So you're going to be testing, by the sound of it then, the teachers and the principals are great, in a great deal more precision than you have in the past.
Well, certainly for those children for whom public education is the opportunity to change their life. But we're also bringing this approach to a whole range of social services, welfare we've already discussed, our vulnerable children and children in care, We're applying it to across the justice system, particularly for our young offenders, but also for recidivist prisoners, where we make an investment calculation, literally, that is understanding the costs and the benefits of what might happen when a prisoner leaves prison, and traditionally 60% of them reoffended, costs $100,000 a year if they go back. So while they're in prison and exiting, when we've got total control over them, we need to do a lot more to ensure that fewer of them come back. Recidivism rates have dropped by about 15%. And now it's getting harder to reduce them.
Well, in fact, Cassandra Goldie from our ACOS here has written a piece asking whether you have actively tracked the individuals who leave your welfare system, which is all part of, you know, very good results that you do talk about, and whether their lives have improved or deteriorated. She suggests that 12 months after people get off welfare, they're often back on it because they can't really cope without some subsidy from the state.
We've got a very clear view about that. So of all the people who went on a welfare benefit in New Zealand last month, over 70% of them had been on a welfare benefit before. So this whole approach we're taking, which I understand the government here is interested in, show us exactly that phenomenon, that the traditional measures of getting people off welfare fall short. Someone simply exiting a benefit is only half the story. The other half is whether it's a sustainable exit. And we don't know a lot about how to sustain the exits, because in the past it hasn't been something the public service focused on. Now that's becoming the next generation of what to do.
What is your rate then of people staying off welfare for, let's say, I think your system is about 6 years old now, isn't it?
Well, it's been we've been doing the calculations for about 4 years, and I'd say that a big challenge here is getting the shift in operational focus in your government departments, and it would be exactly the same challenge in Australia. They've done the same sorts of things for 20 or 30 years. They've built up a culture and skills around that, and we've made progress. I can't give you that number off the top of my head.
But you'd know whether like 20% come back or 40% come back? I mean, you'd know that, wouldn't you?
No, I wouldn't want to make it sound accurate when I can't be exactly sure. What we do know is that of all the large amount of money that is spent on getting people off welfare and into work, we need more of it redirected to sustaining people in employment where we've got the right situation that's likely to lead to them sticking in the workforce. That means taking account often of their housing situation, their problems with debt, other social issues that may be in their family. And we're finding that sustaining employment, for instance, often requires a more integrated support package from government. And we've got some programs that are up and running that are outside our government departments and are more integrated, and we're starting to get some early positive results from that.
Okay, so final question. I mean, if I asked you to distill what you're doing that's different, is it that you're developing a whole new class of sort of, I don't know, a form of social work? Is that what you're really talking about?
Well, look, we're not really doing anything different than isn't being done quite well in places across Australia, for instance. We're just trying to knit it together into a system. We're trying to do two things. One is make sure we understand the life that people are living who are dependent on government, because often that's not well understood. And that means taking a long-term view. And the second thing is set up a learning loop so that when we're interacting with individuals with real challenges, families with real complexity, that we're actually putting ourselves to the test of bringing about change. So it means, and those are really the two vital things. And as the finance minister, I'm able to say, look, let's not focus just on the cost this year. Let's take a 20-year view. And if it's going to take a bit more resource, we'll apply it. But we also have to put ourselves to the test of accountability of changing what happens in these people's lives.
All right, Bill English, look, it's very interesting. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. I hope we can talk to you further.
Thank you very much.
Deputy Prime Minister of New Zealand and Minister for Finance and Housing, Bill English. He'll give the keynote address at a conference this coming week called Coping in an Era of Hyper-Government. It's organised by the Australian New Zealand School of Government, and I'm sure you'll hear quite a bit about it.